Well, good morning, everyone. As many of you know, we started our spring training period a couple of weeks ago. Had an opening ceremony here last Sunday. And so we're using Master Dogen's teaching. Master Dogen was a 13th century Japanese Zen master. And we're using his teaching on this body and mind study of the way sort of focus our training during this ango. And in that fascicle, Dogen taught, to study the way with the body means to study the way with your own body. It's the study of the way using this lump of red flesh. The body comes forth from the study of the way. Everything which comes forth from the study of the way is the true human body. The entire world of the ten directions is nothing but the true human body. The coming and going of birth and death is the true human body. To turn this body around, abandoning the ten unwholesome actions, keeping the eight precepts, taking refuge in the three treasures, and leaving home and entering the homeless life, is the true study of the way. For this reason, it is called the true human body. Those who follow this must not be like outsiders who hold the view of spontaneous enlightenment. And so to turn the body around and abandon the ten unwholesome actions, taking refuge, keeping the eight precepts, leaving home, is the true study of the way, is a study of the true human body. As I mentioned yesterday, Dogen, in speaking about study of the mind, is not just talking about your conscious mind, your cognitive mind, your conceptualizing mind, your brain, but nor is he excluding that. In talking about the true human body, he's not just talking about this physical form, arms and legs, torso, and so on, the lump of red flesh, but he's not excluding that. Clearly. You know, if our basic nature, as Buddhism understands it, is to move towards happiness and to free ourselves of suffering, if it's to realize our unity with all things, to realize that we are inherently perfect and complete, not standing apart, not lacking, if ultimately we want every being to be free, that all things to fulfill their own virtue, then why is it so difficult to live that way? Right? That's a reasonable question to ask. It's a question that every religion has to deal with, basically, because every religion has to, if it's going to stay in business, has to believe that there is some goodness somewhere that is available to us and that we have become distant from, have lost our way from or within, and there has to be a way back. And so Buddhism understands this as the path, as a long path. And we can think of that meaning in the way of thinking that it means it's long and difficult. But Buddhism means, no, really long. Those lifetimes in which in one lifetime you might be a tree, in another you might be a creature, a four-legged creature, in another you might be a moving along the ground creature, in another you're a human being, right? But born into all different kinds of lives, in all different kinds of bodies, right? And so the classic teaching is that, you know, be compassionate to every being because at one point they've been your mother. But really, that means that one being, whoever at one time, no matter who you're meeting, you have been that person. You have been in that form. It could be a very helpful way of looking at things these days. But that through all of those lifetimes, there is what we might call an evolution. Buddhism doesn't really speak of it that way. An evolution of being, of consciousness, rather. because fundamentally we want to be free of suffering. And so that seed, that heart, that essential impulse within us is driving us in every lifetime, unexamined ways, in ways that are turned upside down. And so we end up creating the very suffering that we're trying to free ourselves of. But that because it's inexorable, but it may take many lifetimes, depending on how we spend them, that we are moving along that path of evolution, if you will. I think of that a lot in terms of, you know, what's happening in our own time, you know, as we, in this moment, individually, but also collectively, are experiencing the result of all of our past karma, right? And so we think of our history of racism and sexism, of a kind of dominator model of doing things. We call that patriarchy, right? Of subjugating, which means there has to be inferior and superior. There has to be high and low. There has to be those who are deserving and those who are undeserving. And then there has to be rationale for all of that. And we see all of that in our history, past and present. And in the Black Lives Matter, in Me Too, in the changes that we see moving, and then all of the backlash, the pushback, you know, the neo-Nazis, the white nationalists, that is that actually regression, or is that like the death gasp of a deeper change of consciousness, which is what I believe? Because really there is no going back. There are periods of regression. But if we look at this in terms of, just as we can experience periods of regression in our own practice, right? Everybody's had that experience where they feel like, for reasons not always clear, you know, that just on a basic level, our Zazen is sort of turning to mush, when before it seemed like it was really coming together, right? Or we feel inexplicably caught in old patterns where we thought we were freeing ourselves of those. And so we have these moments where we feel like we're going backwards. But the fact is if we're sincere and we're actually practicing, well, first of all, it's impossible to go backwards. Backwards is a concept, right? There's no going back into time. But more fundamentally, in terms of sort of undoing or actually going retrograde in terms of our actual development, even if we're, you know, dedicated to just indulging every bad habit, we're not going backwards, we're going forwards in a negative way, but we're still going forwards. But if we're sincere and we're actually practicing, it's not possible to go retrograde, to regress into that negativity in any substantial way. That's not the way karma works. That's why understanding karma, that's why establishing intention, that's why being sincere of heart is so important. In a sense, that ensures that we're going to be evolving, to think of it that way, in a affirming positive direction. And so I think of these all of this pushback, right, as you know, if I think of that in how we can experience that on an individual level, how we can at the same time be wanting and feel dedicated to moving forward in our lives and actually awakening wisdom and compassion, we can also step by step fight that, right? And resist that. You know, make this great again, right? It's that sense of there was, you know, of losing something essential and going back to something that wasn't actually good at all, wasn't better. But in our, you know, still becoming clear mind, upside down can seem right side up. It's interesting. I came across an author's some words that he had to say about evolution that were kind of germane, I thought. He said, evolution implies, in its most fundamental form, an organism's natural progression over the course of time, either by accident or by adaptation. In Buddhism, in the human realm, there's when there's intention, there's nothing considered an accident. It's because everything is coming out of a desire. This is quite different from how Darwinism has come to be used to the point that I would argue that they are not really relatable. In its most fundamental form, Darwinism, the idea that has come to be thought of as, implies a cutthroat competition among any two things to guarantee the survival of the fittest. While an organism may evolve over time by means of some natural and self-sustaining mechanism, something locked in Darwinian struggle prevails over its terrestrial competition through shrewd, violent, and or unnatural means. Right? The dominator model. The difference has implications, profound implications, for certain judgments, moral, scientific, metaphysical, societal, individual, educational, financial, every level, about how we make the world. Darwinism frequently implies an agent, usually a human one, aggressively seeking to triumph, while evolution is a process, typically, but not always, correctly assumed to be beneficial, but without a God and lacking an agent. It's very interesting because that question of agency, you know, is an interesting challenge in a sense in Buddhism for most practitioners, because we think, I have to have agency, right? You had to decide to come here this morning. We have to decide to practice, to go to our seat, to meditate, to practice Zazen. We have to commit to practicing the precepts, to living a moral life. There has to be agency, but how can there be agency if there's no self? If there's no abiding entity, essence, soul, personhood, that moment to moment is the continuity. How can we explain continuity? How can we explain a path evolving? How can we explain our own evolution if there's not something that is solid and fixed, that is going through some sort of transformative experience, right? Something that is becoming something else. And this is a question that goes way back into the early years of Buddhism, challenges. How could that be? How could that function? And the Buddha said, basically, it's the moment-to-moment experience that we have through our six senses, the sixth being the mind, that is all there is. That is all that we call life. That is where karma is being created. That is where the consequences of our actions are being experienced. That is where we decide to go in one direction or another. That's all there is. That there doesn't need to be, and there isn't an abiding fixed essence which holds sort of the sort of personal code of you that coheres and moves from one moment to the next, or one life to the next. In a sense, there is nothing but consciousness. But consciousness is understood, needs to be understood well in Buddhism. Thomas Merton, the 20th century Catholic monk, mystic, author, wrote, "As long as we are on earth, the love that unites us, the compassion that unites us, will bring us suffering by our very contact with one another and with ourselves. Because this love is the resetting of a body of broken bones. Even saints or bodhisattvas cannot live with saints or bodhisattvas on this earth without some anguish, without some pain at the differences that come between them." Kind of interesting. So Buddhism understands this as, because we have a human body and we experience pain and pleasure, because we have to sustain this human body, we will experience some degree of suffering even as we proceed on the path of awakening. How we understand that suffering, the suffering, actual suffering that we experience, can change tremendously, such that suffering is alleviated, but in very subtle ways, because we have this human body, there will be very subtle forms of suffering. I mean, to think of the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara. So here one of the stories of Avalokiteshvara is that she was, you know, her vow was to alleviate the suffering of all beings. And so she applied herself and worked really, really hard and had alleviated the suffering of all beings. And that as she was walking away, having completed her task and now moving towards complete enlightenment, she turned back and she saw a whole horde of new suffering, such sentient beings coming over the horizon. And her anguish was so profound that her head burst open. Right? We can kind of identify with that, right? Reading the morning news. Her head burst open. And as she became reconstituted with a little bit of help, she was given some extra heads, right? To hold all of that suffering. So even this great Bodhisattva, right, experienced some suffering, right, at the anguish of others. Merton says, there are two things which people can do about the pain of disunion with other people. They can love or they can hate. And in Buddhism, we would say also that they can become indifferent. They can become numb. In other words, we develop different strategies for what to do about a world that has so much pain in it, and a body and mind that experiences pain. And not just physical pain, but I think at a much deeper level, a spiritual level, a kind of disquietude, right? And a deep kind of inner anxiety at just existing. Because it doesn't last, because we're scared, because we're confused. And so I think within each of us, there is a kind of, perhaps a kind of sadness, right, at life itself, right, particularly when we don't understand this life. And so Merton says there are different ways we can deal with that basic sense of disunion. You know, why is it that in almost every tradition there's a sense of disunion from something, something absolute, something trustworthy, something true? God, Buddha nature. You know, when we see something arise again and again, it's because there's something true, right? There is some sense of having become estranged from something. Isn't that kind of the basic anxiety of our life, that we're trying to connect with something, and so we connect with all kinds of things, much of which doesn't actually provide connection. And even in our connections, even in our healthy, loving, intimate connections, there can still be that inner sense of aloneness, of solitude, of disquiet. And so Merton is saying that whether we examine that or not, particularly if we don't examine that, that there will likely be a couple of basic responses. One is to move towards compassion and love, and the other is to move towards hatred. And he said, hatred recoils from the sacrifice and the sorrow that are the price of the resetting of these bones. I like that image, you know, this true human body that somehow feels broken. And that the cost, the sacrifice, the giving up of resetting that, of finding our union, of finding that ultimate sense of presence, that hatred, that the path of hatred recoils from that. It refuses that pain, right? And that's the basic response of aversion, that the Buddha said is one of the primary ways in which we create suffering, to move away from, to say, no, I do not accept that. I do not see that. That does not exist. Buddhism teaches that the way this true human body is perfect like vast space. Nothing is missing. Nothing is lacking. Nothing is broken. So delusion is really quite simply and troublingly, the sense of brokenness. And because that sense is so strong, so compelling, seems so true, we become in the grips of it. Merton says, there is in every weak, lost, and isolated member of the human race an agony of hatred born of their own helplessness, their own isolation. Hatred is the sign and the expression of this loneliness, of this sense of unworthiness and of insufficiency. And that's a very, very dangerous place to be in, that sense of isolation, that helplessness, right? It becomes more and more dangerous. It becomes dangerous to oneself and to others. And it's interesting to think of this not as a kind of freakish or sort of aberration of nature, but as a sort of a natural response as we become more and more disunited or isolated from our actual nature, right? As that sense of helplessness, of isolation, right, of unworthiness and insufficiency, which is antithetical to what our actual basic state is, right, which is of complete, of unified, of sufficiency, that as we become more and more estranged from that, that we would become more and more agitated, right, more and more troubled, more and more desperate. And so that's where that essential disquietude, right, when it's not examined, when it's not understood, becomes sadness, which is kind of natural and can actually be very powerful if we turn towards it. But when we don't, it becomes fear. And fear is too difficult to tolerate, and so that becomes pain. And then pain becomes anger, and then anger becomes the suffering that I inflict on myself and you. And so Dogen says we have to leave home and enter the homeless life, which means we have to be willing to leave the, and that whole system more and more becomes increasingly true to the person who's experiencing it, right? I mean, we never have an emotion that actually feels wrong, right? We never have a belief that we perceive as untrue, right? That's why it's so difficult to let go. That's why it's so difficult when you're really shifting your way of being, moving towards those wholesome actions, as the Buddha spoke of it, and away from those things that will create more pain and sorrow. But it means giving up certain habits, and I don't mean just, you know, washing the dishes when before you didn't, although that's a good place to start, but, you know, much deeper, much systemic, much more integrated habits you don't even know are habits. They're not habits, they're just ways of being. When we look at and we see the world, you know, particularly from that sort of dominator model, whether we're, you know, the dominator or the dominated, we can see it as wrong or right, but within that there can be also be the sense that it's wrong, but somehow it's still true. That's why it's so hard to let go. I mean, if we knew that it was false, and actually even when we do know it's false, when we've gotten to the point where we realize it's false, and we see the burden that it creates, and we see how it doesn't work, we still reach back for that. And so we can think of leaving home as leaving that, but we can't leave this body. We can't leave this mind. Right? That's what we try and do. We want to transform into somebody else or into another time or another place. And what Dogen is saying here is you have this lump of red flesh. That's the one you have. That's the place in which you turn around. And so the Buddha says, try and live in a way that is skillful, not unskillful. Rather than taking life, affirm it. Rather than taking what doesn't belong to you, be giving. Rather than clouding your mind with all kinds of intoxication, substance, and just busyness and activity. Revere your natural clarity. In other words, use your thoughts, your words, and your actions to liberate yourself. Which means we have to become very aware and astute around those things. What are they? What are the roots of what is unskillful? The Buddha said it's our greed, our anger, and our indifference. And we can think of unskillfulness as, you know, the things that we do that create negative consequences as kind of abstract things. You know, their desires, their this, their that. But actually, by their very nature, in their basic state, they're just uncomfortable. So when we have a desire, even if it's a desire for something good, you know, like a cookie or potato chips or a car or, you know, going out with a friend, if it's the stronger the desire, it's even though it may be a kind of pleasurable discomfort, it's a state of disquietude. It's a state, it's experienced as a kind of imbalance. There's a kind of equilibrium, an equanimity that is not present. And the stronger that desire, the stronger that imbalance is. And so we move towards getting rid of that discomfort, which means to restore that sense of balance. And so if it's a simple pleasure, then it means satisfy that desire, right? Eat that cookie. If it's something deeper, like the sense of the self being threatened, or the sense of my being white and being entitled being threatened, or the sense of me being a man and that the power of that, the privilege that I've been granted because of that being threatened, I experience that as a loss of equanimity, as a loss of balance. It's disturbing to my system. It's hard to tolerate that. And so being unexamined, I will move to try and restore that balance, right? It's not my fault. That's not what I meant. You didn't hear me correctly, right? Or I just, you know, rationalize it. I am better. I do deserve this. And so we can think, if we think of that in terms of how we respond to those kinds of threats, it makes sense. And I feel like my experience is it helps to sort of, you know, stay with that discomfort, which of course is so much of what practice is challenging us to do. Because so much of our confusion and our unwholesome actions and our unskillful movement is not so much going away from something, but it's trying to get, it's going away from that sense of discomfort. It's just a sensory experience in our bodies. And so when Dogen talks about this true human body, we have to practice at that level of thought and emotion and sensation. Right? And so we sit on this cushion and we commit to not turning away. You know, we can think of stillness, the encouragement and the request to be still is just kind of a discipline thing. It's much, much more than that. It's so much deeper than that. It's trying to interrupt that basic strategy of escape. Even if it's just through, you know, subtle movements. It doesn't mean getting up and running out. You know, we can run out in much subtler ways. And that when we ask of ourselves to be just still, then that disquietude, that discomfort can be experienced much more keenly. We can see it. And it begins to shift from our self being at the mercy of that, to we begin to gain a strength, a capacity to simply be uncomfortable. And when you're uncomfortable, simply, then it's not the same. It's not the same discomfort. And then to think of that as we, you know, move into, you know, our study and work with bringing the basic teachings of all beings having Buddha nature, of all beings being in essence equal, of all beings having the deserving to fulfill their nature, not because of what they provide, but simply through being. That is, we do what we have to do individually as a Sangha, collectively as a society, and experience those moments of intense disquietude. We know that something deep and fundamental is being challenged, right? It's like a sign. So the red flag, on the flag it says, you know, it should just say, you are uncomfortable, right? You are uncomfortable because the you that is uncomfortable, the idea of that is being threatened in some fundamental way. Merton says, some of us are aware of this self-hatred, and because of it, we reproach ourselves needlessly. He says, punishment can never cure the feeling that we're unworthy. Never. There's nothing we can do about it as long as we feel that we are isolated, insufficient, helpless, alone. And I disagree, respectfully. I disagree, because there is no absolute state. There is no absolute state of isolation, of absolute state of insufficiency. I mean, so many students who come into practice struggle with this, you know, with a self-critical mind, a self-judging mind, a feeling of unworthiness, a feeling of, I don't deserve to be here, right? That if I do one thing, you know, make one misstep, just as I'm learning how to practice, that I'll be asked to leave. And when people say that, it's like, it's really disturbing to me. And I think, are we doing something to communicate that? That there is no absolute state, and that anybody who comes here, even if you bring that with you, the fact that you're here means you don't believe that entirely. Because if you actually completely believed in those things, you wouldn't come here. You wouldn't seek the Dharma. To come here is to resonate in any way with the Dharma means you already trust on some level. You are worthy, you are sufficient. You have the capacity. You are in solitude in this life, but you are not alone. So there is never nothing we can do about it. That state doesn't exist. There are moments, certainly, where we may feel incapable. We may not know what to do. Right? Things can get very dark in moments, but in actual fact, and I don't just mean in an absolute sense or theoretically, but in an actual sense, there is always something you can do. And that's where understanding the path and the Dharma is so essential, because you then know what that thing is that you can do. Turn the body around. Abandon that unwholesome action. Work with your mind. Take a step, a tiny step in a slightly different direction. Ask for help. This is everyday practice. It's shifting from trying to control, right, or dominate, right, because that is the model, even if we're not in a dominating group. So we try and dominate this. We try and dominate our mind. And so it's shifting from that mode, that paradigm, to a mode of acceptance. Working with rather than against. A mode of rather than avoidance and denial, to presence. To being able to be in the presence of whatever appears. That we feel on some level we're not capable of meeting. A loss, aging, death, my own oppressive tendencies, my own ignorance, my own attachments. that when we shift to actually allowing ourselves to be present to those aspects, that's not just turning the body around, it's turning the world around. Merton says the beginning of the, somebody was talking to me about this yesterday. He says the beginning of the fight against hatred. And it's so interesting, it's so hard to get away from that paradigm. Right? That we're going to fight fighting. We're going to, you know, go to war against war. We're going to go to war against racism, war against sexism. We're going to fight it. We're going to dominate. We're going to beat it down until we're peaceful. Right? Well, you know what? It seems like we've been going at that for a long time. With everything we had, it doesn't work. It means we have to really begin thinking of different ways of thinking and of speaking, because speaking words have power. So we might say the beginning of the practice of hatred. He says the basic Christian answer to hatred is not the commandment to love, but what must necessarily come before in order to make the commandment bearable and comprehensible. It is a prior commandment, that is, to have faith. Interesting. In other words, how do we prepare ourselves to face what is difficult to face, to acknowledge what we don't want to acknowledge, to take up what we don't want to take up? That before even compassion, right, we have to actually just believe, have a basic faith in what? In this Dharma, which is nothing other than the real nature of all things, and then the teachings that express that, in the nature of the world as a self-intelligent, self-organizing, self-healing entity that we are a part of. We can think of ourselves as a separate thing. There's human beings, and then there's the rest, the earth and all of its creatures. Have faith in that. Faith in your own self-nature as being that very thing. Faith in your capacity. Faith in your ability to get lost. In your ability to actually make a mess of things. And then to recover. To see that, to take responsibility. Because the fact is if we want to walk a path that is true, we will make a mess of it along the way, right? It's not a linear thing. And so that's part of what we have to be able to tolerate, right? And we can speak of it as imperfection, but that's just a reaction to the deluded view that we're supposed to be perfect. And so it's like, okay, finally we realize we can't be perfect, so you settle for being imperfect. And maybe that's a good, maybe that's a necessary medicine, but it's still based in that basic model. What if we just drop that altogether and just be? That it's not a matter of being somewhere on this spectrum of being completely imperfect or completely perfect. It's just being. Just be a person. Because we can do that. We can do that. And so it's having faith in this, in our ability to just simply practice, to turn this body and mind around, to see something we haven't seen before, to take up something we have not wanted to take up, to stop when we want to run, to be still when we're restless, to face and meet eyes with one we have not met eyes with before. We can do those things. And the nature of the path is you do it in this moment. And then you do it in this moment. And then you do it in this moment. We can do that. When you think, okay, I have to be in accord with the Buddha way forever. You can't do that, right? From an absolute point of view, that's your nature, right? A completely enlightened being, that's the way they live. There's only one of those that comes around, right? Every once in a long while, according to Buddhism. So that means we're all along that path of being, right? Not a path of, you know, 0 to 100. A path that is unmeasured. Master Dogen said, this boundless sky and the entire earth, which is your true human body, your basic mind, they are like unrecognized words, unrecognized realities, unrecognized possibilities. He said, it's like a voice from the deep. I think many of us have had that experience. We encounter the Dharma. I know that was my experience. I encountered the Dharma, and it was like I was hearing a voice from the deep that were familiar, though I'd never heard them before. How do we explain such a thing? Maybe we don't need to. Maybe it's not about that. I'll end with a poem by Wendell Berry. Geese appear high over us. They pass, and the sky closes. Abandon, as in love or sleep, holds them to their way. Clear is their ancient faith. What we need is here. And we pray not for a new earth or heaven, but to be quiet in the heart and in the eye, clear. What we need is here. This is what the Buddha realized 25 centuries ago. What you need is here, and in here means closer than you think. Here means don't take a step in any direction. Clear means, here means your natural body and mind.
Thanks so much for listening. The monastery's quarterly journal, Mountain Record, has a new home at mountainrecord.org. For over 30 years, Mountain Record has been offering spiritual seekers of all faiths a unique journey through words and images. Each quarterly issue delivers a thought-provoking array of classic teachings, contemporary wisdom, stunning photographs, and news from the Mountains and Rivers Order. For more information, to subscribe, or to read our open access articles, visit mountainrecord.org.